Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today is the 50th Facing the Future episode, and I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim for the first Economist Mom segment of the new year. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The current government shutdown entered into record territory over the weekend as elected leaders were unable to come to an agreement on funding the remainder of the federal government, as well as funding for a border wall. The last record was a 21-day funding lapse during the Clinton era. With no tangible progress to report, there's no way of knowing how much longer this shutdown will continue. What is clear is that it's quickly beginning to take on a human face. On Friday, 800,000 federal employees missed their first paycheck as a result of the deadlock in Washington. Last week, the House passed legislation that would fund and reopen the Interior Department, the Environmental Protection Agency, and Forest Service. Republican leadership in the Senate has said they will not bring the bills to a vote until Democrats and President Trump finalize a deal over border wall funding. But perhaps there is beginning to be a weakening of that stance. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Trump admin ally, increased political pressure to end the shutdown by calling for a short-term funding measure to reopen agencies while immigration talks continue, urging support for a three-week stopgap measure that would reopen most of the government while negotiators try to reach a bipartisan immigration deal that includes funding for a southern border wall. Graham also spent last week trying to negotiate a broader immigration deal that would combine wall funding with Democratic priorities, but quickly abandoned the effort, called for the president to bypass Congress altogether, but then reversed course once more, calling for the short-term funding package. The president may even try to pay for part of a border wall with money the government collects from seized assets. Such funds, which come from assets seized in criminal and sometimes civil legal cases, are controlled in two separate pots by the Justice and Treasury Departments. And administration officials have been scouring the books looking for any unobligated funds that might be used for a border wall. But there's skepticism, even amongst Republicans, that such efforts will garner sufficient funds for a wall. This shutdown may be more about positioning for power than anything else, as it is the first big test of how power will be wielded in a divided government during the Trump administration. Perhaps there is concern that caving on either side would set a precedent for even more dangerous rounds of political brinksmanship in the coming months and years. And I'm looking ahead at this summer, when Congress will need to raise or suspend the debt limit again. Defaulting on the nation's debt would wreak havoc in financial markets and risk undermining U.S. securities as the safest asset for global investors. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for the next edition of our Economist Mom segment. We'll be talking about the State of the Union. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. Diane and Bob are both regular contributors on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you.
So this is our 50th Facing the Future program, the first Economist Mom segment of 2019, and the last one before the president's upcoming State of the Union address. So I feel like it's a pretty monumental moment for the program. And I wanted to spend some time talking about sort of the state of the fiscal union for our nation. But I feel like there's an elephant in the room we have to address before we even get there. And since the State of the Union is sort of like an annual review of how the federal government is doing and where our nation is headed, I thought before we got to the forward-looking aspects of a State of the Union. Maybe the two of you could give an initial grade on the, how the federal government performed this year.
Well, you know, Diane and I were trying to schedule an annual review for the federal government, but nobody showed up because they're shut down. Oh, I don't know. What do you do? What do you do when your annual interview for the annual review, the people don't show up? I don't know.
They don't want to hear what they're grade is, honestly.
So if the federal government was in the room and they had showed up, what would you be saying to elected leaders right now?
Well, so what I would say is, you know, the first role in your job is to get your basic job done. And in fact, I was looking up what President Trump had said in his 2018 address, and apparently he had called on both parties to put politics aside and, quote, get the job done, unquote. And so I would say that they didn't exactly put politics aside. They didn't exactly get the job done. They're getting none of their job done right now. And so, you know, they basically deserve a D or an F as their grade for this year.
So how did we get here? How do we have the longest government shutdown in the history of our nation? Why is it that we can't come to agreement, or elected leaders can't come to agreement on funding the remainder of the government?
I think it's beyond dysfunction. It's almost deliberate, mendacious actions. I will say I think it is something to do with, you might say, a rookie mistake on the part of the president. I think he is not that sophisticated in how Washington budgets work. And, you know, the idea is you put your, the president puts his budget out, and in this case he asked for $1.6 billion for the wall in his budget, for the border wall. And being determined to have a bipartisan process, the Senate Budget Committee, the Senate Appropriations Committee, gave him exactly that amount. And the Democrats thought they were being very bipartisan, and it turned out somewhere along the line in the summer, I think it was, the president decided that wasn't enough money and he wanted more. The Democrats said they didn't want to give any more, and the Senate went along with the $1.6 billion. And then the president again decided, well, okay, maybe I'll do that. We'll keep the government open and argue about this next year. And then, as you know, some of the right-wing conservative media commentators accused the president really of going soft, and you know, he took them seriously, and rather than dealing with the people who were writing the bills, he seemed responsive to right-wing media instead. And that's what I call a rookie mistake. I mean, you've got to be able to stand up to your base, to kind of ignore. I mean, those are entertainers. They're commentators. He really, if he wants the wall, he's going to have to get it from the Congress. And so anyway, it quickly devolved into a very partisan standoff, which was worse because the Democrats had taken over control of the House. So they just had and continue to have increased leverage on this point. And the president continues to just, you know, it's like when you're, it's wheel spinning. When you're stuck in a, you've gone off the road, you're just gunning the engine and trying to spin the wheels rather than sort of, you know, rocking the car gently back and forth and trying to get some people to help pull you out of the ditch. So that's kind of how we ended up where we are, and there's no obvious way out.
And it seems just, this is, you know, innocent bystander Chase chiming in here, it almost feels like more of a power move by either party to sort of dig their heels in and not come to compromise, especially since this is the beginning of divided government under the Trump administration, with Democrats taking the majority in the House. You agree with that? I mean, there doesn't seem to be a light at the end of the tunnel here. No one seems willing to give.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, let's say that President Trump is a rookie because he has never worked for government before, worked in government, and he just doesn't understand how work does get done in government and how necessary compromise and leadership and, you know, willingness to cooperate and work together with people on the other side. He has never experienced having to do that. So it's been a problem because the people that have worked for his administration have been around him and tried to kind of educate him on on how government public service is done, they are increasingly dropping away from him. So I think that it is beyond dysfunction. It's like he's never known how to function and how government is different from running a business, or certainly being the CEO of a company. And it's causing our government to not be able to do its basic function.
To underscore that, I mean, it's important to keep going back, because people could say, well, you know, aren't the Democrats being intransigent too? And yeah, in a way they certainly are, but it's the president that's trying to initiate something. He's the one that's trying to get a new policy enacted. So the burden of proof, in effect, is on him. And there was a bipartisan deal. I mean, that's the point, is that there was a deal, everything was all set, and he himself blew it up.
So the question I had for both of you, what do you think it'll take for either side to sort of pull the ripcord and give? I mean, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, less about the politics of the shutdown and more about the reality of a shutdown and the impact it has. So I guess a transition point to that aspect of the conversation would be, what do you think it'll take? Is it a dramatic fall off in economic growth, some kind of mini crisis? Like what gets either side or both sides to the table on some sort of agreement?
Well, I think like a lot of issues that we talk about on the show, it is going to take some more obvious discontent from the American public. And, you know, I think we've seen some polling results that show that people are blaming the administration and the Republicans in Congress more than the Democrats for this shutdown, and don't necessarily, I think, only a minority of Americans support the idea of building the wall. And so, I think that the longer this goes on, and the more ordinary Americans, by the way, understand that there's a human toll of the government being shut down. This is not just this other world that exists inside the Beltway in Washington, but this affects millions of Americans, I think, and that it starts to actually hurt local economies because of government workers being out of work. I think that it sort of puts a more human face, a real picture to the government shutdown. So it's not just about dysfunction in politics in Washington. It becomes like, hey, this is hurting all of us in more obvious ways. So just like when the Republicans were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and Americans for the first time started to pay attention to what they got from Obamacare, and only when they were coming close to actually getting rid of it did Americans kind of speak up about it and say, hey, no, we like this. We want this to continue. Only then did it sort of change the political wind about Obamacare. So I feel like in some perverse way, you know, it's an unfortunate way to learn a lesson, but I feel like the shutdown is making the news, right? So people are paying a lot more attention to what does the government provide us. Like, you know, people might not have been aware that the government is responsible for security at the airport. They might not have been aware that the government funds just picking up the trash in national parks. You know, so all these things that are a little bit more tangible to people and more visible and make the news, in a way, this is part of educating the American public about the role of government and getting them to pay more attention to what their members of Congress and what the president, what they're supposed to be doing in their job.
Yeah, I agree that what will end this is public disgust, because right now both parties, the leaders of both parties, perceive an advantage in the standoff. And when that turns negative, and it may turn negative on both sides. I mean, when the public goes sour on this in a big way, I think you'll find pressure on both parties to come to the table. But the president's not in an advantageous position at this point, because he will get the blame for it.
This is Facing the Future, and I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. In the first Economist Mom segment of the new year, we're talking a bit about the partial government shutdown that is now the longest in U.S. history. We're going to talk about the State of the Union, the fiscal union, shortly. But before we transition to that, Diane, you started talking about some of the sort of human capital challenges that we're starting to see come to light as a result of this shutdown or partial shutdown. Can you and Bob give some insight on perhaps some of the government procedural challenges that come up as a result of a shutdown like this?
You know, certain agencies that are involved in the shutdown are responsible for things that people rely on, well, will start to rely on. I'm thinking mostly of Treasury Department and IRS, that currently no refunds are yet being processed for 2018 tax year, but we've already noticed my colleagues and I at District Economics Group, we've been watching the daily tax receipts and refunds, and you see that refunds that would have gone out based on 2017 returns, late filings and amended returns, they have not been processed. So we've seen several days of zero refunds going out Treasury's door. We've seen, you know, data that are normally collected by the government, so I'm bringing my economist hat bias to this emphasis, but there are no data. Census isn't releasing data. Commerce Department, in terms of the Bureau of Economic Analysis, that puts out reports of this week we're supposed to find out about retail sales, which is an important barometer on how the economy's doing. So I guess the bottom line is that the shutdown hurts economic activity. It also hurts our ability to understand how the economy is doing. So we're not going to know much about how the economy is doing as a result of the shutdown for a while, because it's going to be, all of our government statistics are basically on pause right now, although not BLS. BLS is Bureau of Labor Statistics, as part of the Labor Department, is one of the agencies that is still open for business.
There are some practical things like people applying for mortgages and other loans that need to have their income verified, or their loan applications approved through one of the federal agencies that does lending, that they're on hold. Business regulations, business licensing that needs mm-hmm. to happen is suspended now. There's food inspection. There's payments to farmers that were agreed to provide relief from the tariffs. That they're not getting their money. So there's a range of things aside from unpaid TSA agents and air traffic controllers. I would rather that those people be paid. Coast Guard, I think, is not paid. I may be wrong about that. I'm not sure about the budget, but I think there are certainly some border control entities and judges. I mean, we're going to find courts shutting down pretty soon because the Justice Department is one of the agencies that hasn't had their budget approved.
Yeah, I believe I read an article that said the Coast Guard at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard was furloughed or not being paid for the work they're doing right now as a result of the shutdown. So I think you're right, Bob.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it'll bubble up. I mean, is this continuous going? Remember, we've just had the first missed paycheck. And so up until then, it was a little bit of a free ride for the shutdown in terms of its impact. But now you're really getting, people aren't getting paid, and that's serious stuff. And I suspect that it will come to an end within maybe 2 weeks, but that's still a long time.
Yeah, seeing that second check come back with a zero might be the straw that breaks the camel's back on this particular shutdown, already the longest in our nation's history. And Diane, you gave the federal government a D or F on their annual review for their efforts this year, and that's not great, certainly not a passing grade. And you also mentioned that you went back and looked at President Trump's State of the Union from 2018 and pulled a couple quotes from that. And I did something similar to get an idea of some of the main topics or issues that were addressed in that State of the Union. They were largely related to immigration, health care, the economy, mm-hmm. and infrastructure. And there's also sort of a typical pattern in State of the Union speeches. The president offers his opinion concerning important values or national character. He discusses his legislative agenda and offers policy recommendations. I'd like to do something similar today. So my question to the two of you, if you were giving a State of the Fiscal Union, what would be some of the important values you'd be calling upon elected leaders to either maintain or get back to in the next year?
I think I would emphasize continued that the government needs to continue to honor its commitments to provide, you know, obviously first the funding of everyday operations of the government, but in terms of, renewing their commitment to the major spending programs and tax programs that are in the federal budget that make up the biggest portions of our expenditures and receipts. So, you know, renewing a commitment to the Social Security and Medicare programs and Medicaid programs for low-income health care, shoring up the Affordable Care Act in order to make sure that some of the sources of revenue that were supposed to go toward to support the cost of the ACA are maintained or renewed or reinstated. Our basic problem has been with the federal budget outlook has been that we have repeatedly been unwilling to look for ways to balance spending with receipts, and our economy is no longer an excuse, is not an excuse at this moment to be falling short, to have receipts falling short of our spending needs. And so I think what I would call on in terms of the fiscal State of the Union is just a serious reconciling of our economic circumstances with our fiscal shortfall. It's just a total mismatch at this point in time.
I guess I would, I we're coming from the same position, and so I'll emphasize a couple of key points there. If I were to give a State of the Fiscal Union, I think I would be one of the few presidents to start off by saying it was bad. I think Jerry Ford is about the only one I can remember ever starting out on kind of a negative note, but it clearly is, and I think it's important to diagnose why, and you can go through the demographics, and I would try to make the link solidly between fiscal responsibility and economic growth. Economic growth is a lot more popular than fiscal responsibility, and you get, you know, both sides wanting to come up with ideas that will emphasize economic growth, which is obviously a good thing, but they usually tend to leave out the fiscal responsibility side of it. And so you get, you know, proposals for large unfunded tax cuts or large unfunded spending increases that might actually be good ideas in the abstract, but they keep making the hole deeper and deeper, and we've already got an unsustainable problem as it is. So I guess I would try to make a case for a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda, and I'd throw in a couple of things, you know, so that could include a higher spending on research and development or tax credits for those things that would help the economy expand. That might include infrastructure, but, you know, breaking new technologies to help expand, because in order to really help the economy, the policies need to expand the workforce and expand the productivity of the workforce. And I think one of the issues that gets so little attention is the demographic impact on the workforce. I mean, we are an aging population. The workforce growth has slowed substantially, and that has a lot to do with the slow economic projections going forward, just because the workforce isn't growing as strong. So the most controversial thing I would put on the table is an increase in legal immigration, because we need the workers, and we need high-skilled workers, but we also need low-skilled workers. So having a more rational immigration policy would be part of that agenda, but that alone isn't going to solve our problems. You have to do the things that Diane was talking about, also aligning our entitlement program promises with revenues. So I guess I would put out the political agenda from hell, which is lower spending on entitlement programs, higher revenues, and increased immigration.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. In our Economist Mom segment, we're discussing the state of the fiscal union. And one of my follow-up questions for both of you, you sort of started going down that path. I wanted to know what you would throw out as a legislative agenda in the State of the Fiscal Union address that either of you might be giving. And Bob, you mentioned that your particular platform or agenda would probably not be all that well received. And I think one thing that is often lacking in State of the Union addresses is detail. So I wanted to back up a little bit and maybe touch on some of the topics that were mentioned in President Trump's 2018 State of the Union: healthcare, the economy, infrastructure. You touched on immigration. You added in workforce growth and investment. Maybe the two of you would take a second here and talk a little bit about healthcare, since it's one of the biggest expenditures in the federal budget, one of the fastest growing in terms of cost, and maybe throw into the mix how you might start to tackle those key programs or challenges even as soon as within the next year?
Well, I think that it is one of the biggest challenges still in terms of role of government. I think that government, in terms of helping households with their daily lives, there's still a large number of Americans who are uninsured or don't have affordable options for paying for health care services. And the ACA, Obamacare, helped, but there's still a need to figure out a better way of financing health care for many households. And so I think that that's the trouble we've had over the years, is that people have wanted some way of reducing uninsurance rates, and yet we've struggled to find ways to pay for that health care. So I think that is something that came out of the Obamacare debates, and I think that we just need to keep making sure that the Affordable Care Act is sound in terms of financing, and we need to continue to work on working with the states who are, and the making sure the exchanges are working. So that's what I guess for healthcare. I think that's it's not clear to me that, you know, we didn't really fundamentally reform our health care insurance system. We just offered through Obamacare a means of people who aren't covered by employer-provided health insurance to get some coverage.
I think if there are long-shot type of things that are good over the long term and would you know, if you want an immediate agenda, it would be hard to enact, particularly given the fact that the things are so acrimonious on the Hill at the moment. But I think that one thing we need to do more to get away from fee-for-service medicine and continue experiments to pay for quality of care rather than quantity of care. So that's one thing. And there are efforts that have been going on. That's an ongoing process, and I would want to continue that process, which I think the Trump administration is amenable to. Initially, there was some resistance to that, I think, with the first Secretary Tom Price, but I think the current secretary is more on board with that kind of an agenda, and I've seen some encouraging things there. The second one is the idea of modifying somehow the employer-provided health care deduction, which is one of the biggest tax expenditures in the budget and encourages overspending, in a sense, on health care. It values health care spending for comprehensive insurance programs over compensation, you know, pay, and because it's a tax deduction for the worker. And so, you know, some sort of rationalizing that system, maybe making the deduction less valuable or something, so it's not encouraging higher and higher spending, which is not getting higher, you know, better and better results. So those are two things that are kind of long shots, but probably the most immediate thing that has a chance of actually happening is some sort of prescription drug benefit, you know, trying to control prescription drug prices in a way that allows for competition and allows the pharmaceutical companies to make a profit, but it would have to, you know, have some sort of government mandated competition, maybe for Medicare, so that you know, Medicare is not paying so much for prescription drugs, and that might help bring the cost of drugs overall down. So I think that there's some interest on both sides in doing a bill in that regard. And so, if I had to say any sort of short-term thing, it would be in that area.
I think it was interesting that you brought up the employer-provided health exclusion from income taxes, because I think that is an interesting policy issue because of the fact that we're hearing Democrats talk about, House Democrats in particular, talk about ways to raise tax burdens on the rich. And so this is an area where tax policy and health care policy overlap, and it's a largely invisible way in which the government subsidizes health care. Because it's not even an explicit deduction from people's individual income tax returns. It's just left out. So when you get your W-2, you don't have to report how much your employer spent on your health insurance. And so it's just left out of the income tax system, and that exclusion makes it, you know, most people don't really think about it as part of their income. And as a result, that benefit is invisible to them, and as well as the cost that they actually incur when they purchase health care because their insurance covers it. So I think that is an area that's the potential for tax reform as well as health care reform, and it is one of the biggest subsidies that the government makes through the tax code is subsidizing employer-provided health care.
And I think, just like in past episodes, we could spend the entire segment talking about those long-term reforms, Bob, that you sort of sidestepped here because I called upon you to address some issues in the short term over the next year or so. So thank you for answering the call of the question. It's like being in law school all over again. And just so our State of the Fiscal Union doesn't go too long here, I'm going to cut it down to just addressing one more potential policy priority. And it was a hot topic during the last State of the Union. It was a hot topic over the remainder of the year, but it ultimately didn't really go anywhere, and that is infrastructure investment. So if you're giving a State of the Fiscal Union on our level of infrastructure investment as a nation and perhaps calling for more, what would that sound like? How would you pay for it? What recommendations would you make?
Infrastructure is a boring word, by the way, but it basically is roads or airports or anything that's going to support transportation and industry and passengers and consumers and travelers. It keeps us going, and so it's good for commerce, and it's good for all of us. And it's easy to overlook because we don't really think about when we're driving over a bridge, is this thing about to fall down? Is anybody maintaining it? And we just assume that airports are going to run smoothly and we're going to get from point A to point B, and trains, and we don't even think about freight trains and rail transportation and how all the goods and services get around the country. I suppose pretty soon we'll have to add drones to infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
But but it's terribly important, and we tend to underinvest in that regard because, shocking to say, people don't want to pay for things. I mean, you like all the good stuff, and oh my goodness, this costs money. We have to do this. So, and then there's the other tendency politically to invest in new stuff rather than maintaining old stuff, which you still need to do, because if you have a new bridge, you can call it the Chase Hagerman Bridge. And
I like the ring. It has a nice ring to it.
You know, but if you shore up some existing bridge, nobody says, you know, this is the Chase Hagerman refurbishing project or something. It's not as rewarding politically. So anyway, I think there are possibilities, but again, I would get back to it. You do have to have some consideration for how you pay for it, and so you get into things like user fees and gas tax or mileage fees to pay for transportation infrastructure, airline, ticket taxes and things like that. All of which should be on the table for increase, because I think the public is ready to accept more targeted tax increases. Tax increases are never popular, but if people know what it's going for and it's a designated user fee or user tax, it's more popular because people can understand exactly what it's being used for.
I will say that in terms of infrastructure, there was one interesting thing that came out in the past week or so, and that was the Chamber of Commerce came out with kind of their wish list for the State of the Union proposals, and one of the things they said was that there's a lot of infrastructure work that needs to be done, but they also, what I found interesting was they suggested that raising fuel gasoline taxes could be part of the solution. So that's an example of people don't seem to have a problem with paying for infrastructure, especially when it seems kind of tied, related to it. So using gas taxes to pay for highway improvements or raising tobacco taxes to pay for children's health care is another example that people kind of, politicians seem and business leaders seem much more supportive of paying for things when there's some kind of connection in the purpose of the tax or the purpose of the spending.
Okay, coming near the end of our segment here, I've got one last question for the two of you. It's relates to the State of the Union and also a subject that we didn't really go in depth on, and that is the fact that we have almost a $22 trillion total national debt, that we have growing budget deficits expected to hit $1 trillion and more from fiscal year 2020 and beyond for the first time in our nation's history when the economy is still actually growing. And we've even got the Federal Reserve Chairman coming out and saying he's concerned about the long-term ramifications of our nation's debt buildup. So that's the backdrop, in addition to a government shutdown that might actually still be ongoing when the president gives his next State of the Union speech. From both of your perspectives, what do you hope to hear from President Trump during that speech? In an ideal world, what do you want him to touch on?
In an ideal world, I would like some acknowledgement that the budget deficit situation is problematic right now, that it's too large, and that there is some plan or vision of needing to have a plan to raise more revenue and prioritize spending better.
In the ideal world, I certainly would agree, and I don't think that we are going to see that ideal world, but certainly the most important thing in a really big picture sense is the acknowledgement of the problem and the willingness to negotiate solutions without preconditions. That's what we emphasized on the fiscal wake-up tour that we did years ago, is if you first acknowledge the problem, and so we're dealing with the same set of facts, and stop complaining about the Congressional Budget Office, and let's say they're nonpartisan, they're as good as we get on neutral, credible numbers. Let's use the CBO numbers, and then let's negotiate. And if you are going to have a negotiation, about a long-term problem like this, you can't come into it with preconceived points that have to be off the table, because then you can't have a real negotiation. So you can't, for example, say on the Republican side, you can't say no new revenue. We're just not going to do it, so let's not even consider it. And on the Democratic side, you can't just say, well, no, we're going to have Medicare for all, or we don't go into a negotiation. We're not going to put any changes to the major entitlement programs on the table. In fact, we're going to expand them. So you go into that, and that's not much of a negotiation. So, yeah, in the ideal world, acknowledge the problems and express a willingness to negotiate without preconditions.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim. During the Economist Mom segment, we touched on the partial government shutdown as well as the state of the fiscal union. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chase. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. Amidst a partial government shutdown and on the heels of a failed attempt at bipartisan reform to the budget process in the last Congress, it's an appropriate time for another reminder. There is no substitute for political will. That is the case when it comes to the budget process, proposed reforms to it, and really any serious long-term reforms on just about any major political issue. But for the moment, let's focus on the budget process. No change or trigger mechanism can take the place of good old-fashioned leadership. Given that the process has remained essentially unchanged since 1974, many believe it is overdue for a facelift. And after decades of dysfunction, there's no shortage of proposals in Congress or in academia for improving the federal budget process. Just about any reform would be a step in the right direction, but it ultimately would not substitute for the political will to make difficult decisions. A prime example of this reality is the pay-as-you-go or PAYGO rules that we discussed last week. PAYGO requires that any legislation that lowers revenues or expands mandatory spending be offset with revenue increases or mandatory spending cuts. Violations are supposed to be enforced through automatic cuts in other programs. While PAYGO is an important standard that should be adhered to, in practice, this component of the budget process has regularly been waived for major deficit-increasing legislation. In the past, there have also been legislative triggers, budget deals with planned cuts in later years, sequestration, and other mechanisms or gimmicks to force or feign fiscal responsibility. In most cases, delayed cuts in spending or losses in revenue compounded to the point of being completely unrealistic, so Congress often gave up on whatever mechanism or gimmick it was supposedly bound by and passed new legislation that relinquished its obligations or achieved only a fraction of the savings. The lesson is clear. It is ultimately up to policymakers to set policy, and no amount of procedural changes can make them do anything they lack the political will to do on their own. As that reality sets in, consider the following. Last year, the International Monetary Fund reported that the United States is the only economically advanced country in the world that plans to dig itself deeper into debt over the next 5 years. And just last week, the current Fed chair, Jerome Powell, had this to say about the nation's debt. Quote, "I'm very worried about it. It's a long-run issue that we definitely need to face, and ultimately, we will have no choice but to face it." You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.